In 1829, a Mexican explorer was traveling westward when he noticed green wetlands in the middle of the Mojave Desert. He named the area the Meadows. In Spanish, it's Las Vegas. Fort Baker was built there in 1864. The fort remained an outpost for 77 years. But in 1931, the state of Nevada legalized gambling. 10 years later, large casinos came to the Meadows. Along with them came vice and organized crime. It's been said Las Vegas has always been a city on the border of legality, providing its neighbors with what is normally prohibited. Today, Vegas draws 41 million visitors a year. And what's happened there happened in the Valley of Salt during the days of Abraham. For another sin city rose in infamy in the desert. Sodom and its sister city, Gomorrah, were the Las Vegas of their day. Built around freshwater springs in the desert of the Dead Sea, it too gained an infamous reputation. Ezekiel 16, verse 49, lists Sodom's sins. She was guilty of gluttony, idleness, a disregard for the poor and needy, haughtiness, as well as lewdness and abominations. Just like Las Vegas, Sodom sat on the border of legality. Sins regulated in a few places, tolerated in most places, were celebrated in Sodom. Perhaps most notorious was Sodom's wholesale embrace of sexual perversion. The city totally capitulated to homosexuality. Today we get the term sodomy from Sodom. It was gay pride day every day in Sodom. And in Genesis 19, we see what God thinks about the sins of Sodom, which is vital for us today. For the judgment of Sodom foreshadows the coming future judgment destined for the world in the last days. For in Luke 17, Jesus told us, "As it was also in the days of Lot, even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed." And so verse 1. Now the two angels, these were Abraham and Sarah's visitors, remember? They were angels disguised as men. They came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. Now remember when Lot left Abraham, Uncle Abe had given him the option to settle in any direction he chose. Chapter 13, verse 12 says that he pitched his tent as far as Sodom. Apparently the pleasure and the convenience and the entertainment and the commerce and the variety of this world attracted Lot and his family. Lot started out pitching his tent as far as Sodom. But when we see him again, chapter 14, verse 12, we're told, Lot dwelt in Sodom. Notice the lure of the city had pulled him in, had drawn him in. Now we see him sitting in the gate of Sodom, which doesn't refer so much to a site as it does to Lot's status. For Lot had risen to prominence. Only the leaders of the city sat in its gates. Now Lot is a city official. Pay attention to the progression. He starts out looking towards Sodom. He ends up living in Sodom. Finally, he becomes a leader of Sodom. He sees, then he settles, and then he serves. And this is how the world sucks us in. Our eyes lead us astray. We set our sights on the world's prestige and places of prominence and pleasure. Then we settle into a lifestyle bent on obtaining what we see. Finally, we end up supporting and justifying that lifestyle even when we lose the taste for it ourselves. Lot was drawn in slowly, yet surely. It's interesting, 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 8 says of Lot, "That righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds." You know, very little in Genesis indicates Lot was righteous. But apparently Peter thought he was. And yet take a righteous man and put him in wicked surroundings, and over time it begins to take its toll. It takes its toll on your soul. Sodom's evils tortured Lot and toppled his family, as we'll see. Well, again, verse 1, when Lot saw the angels, he arose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. And he said, "Hear now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise early and go on your way." And they said, "No, but we will spend the night in the open square." But he insisted strongly. And the reason Lot insisted strongly was his knowledge of the city. For he knew that nights in Sodom saw homosexual predators roam the streets, raping and robbing defenseless strangers. There was nothing gay about them. And Lot couldn't bear the thought of two messengers from God becoming the brunt of such treatment. And so he insisted strongly. And they turned into him and entered his house. And then he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Verse 4. Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house. And they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them carnally. They want to sexually abuse these men. A gang of same-sex rapists are banging on Lot's door." So Lot went out to them through the doorway, shut the door behind him, and said, "Please, my brethren, do not do so wickedly." Now these men had lost all conscience. They'd come from all over Sodom. A perverse lust had taken them over. They're out to ravage and brutalize these innocent visitors. But it's interesting to me, notice what Lot surprisingly calls them in verse 7. "My brethren." My brethren? You see, make this world your family and you'll get some unsavory brothers. This shows the totality of Lot's compromise. Imagine the morals and the truth that Lot had to ignore. Imagine the convictions he had to overlook to get to this point, to reach the point where he would call these men brothers. And then he suggests an unimaginable alternative. He says, "See now, I have two daughters who have not known a man. They were virgins. Please let me bring them out to you, and you may do to them as you wish. Only do nothing to these men, since this is the reason they have come under the shadow of my roof." What in the world are you thinking, Lot? Offering your virgin daughters to be brutalized by these beasts? Now, there are commentaries that chalk this up, Lot's offer up, to the Oriental custom of respecting visitors and to the Canaanites' low view of women at the time. Even so, I still can't relate to Lot's thinking. He's compromising his little girls. His carnality has stripped him of any courage he once had. It has confused his loyalties. This is inexcusable. In fact, there are gay activists today who suggest that this chapter has nothing to do with homosexuality. It's all about Sodom's lack of hospitality to strangers. Really? Talk about a bias clouding the issue. They're not reading the text. Same-sex lust and perverse desire were part of the sin of Sodom, and it turned ugly and violent, and God brought judgment. And they said, "Stand back." Then they said, "This one came in to stay here, and he keeps acting as a judge." In other words, they're turning now on Lot. "Now we will deal worse with you than with them." So they pressed hard against the man Lot and came near to break down the door. But the men, who were men disguised as angels, they reached out their hands and pulled Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they became weary trying to find the door. Notice the blindness itself didn't shut down their lust and aggression. You'd think if you were struck by a sudden blindness, you'd sort of stop what you were doing and maybe pay attention to God. Instead, they keep groping violently in the dark. Verse 12, then the men, that is the angels, said to Lot, have you anyone else here, son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whoever you have in the city? Better take them out of this place, for we will destroy this place, because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and spoke to his son-in-laws who had married his daughters and said, get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. Oh my. But to his son-in-laws, he seemed to be joking. What a tragic reaction. You see, Lot's compromises in Sodom had forfeited his credibility. He has spent so much time trying to fit in that no one could imagine him standing up. And here's the vital question for you and me. If we suddenly took a stand for God and for truth and for what's right, would our worldly friends think we were just joking? Verse 15. When the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. And while he lingered, Lot lingered. Can you imagine? Sodom is about to be incinerated. But rather than run, he lingers. It just proves the powerful grip this world can have on us, even in the face of judgment. And here's God's grace in action. It's really beautiful. The men took hold of Lot's hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of the two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him. And they brought him out and set him outside the city. God literally pulled Lot and his wife out of the city. And I wonder if every time we're tempted, God doesn't grab our spirit and pull us away. So that to really sin, we have to shake him off and linger. Verse 17. So it came to pass when they had brought them outside that he said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. And then Lot said to them, please know, my lords, indeed now your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have increased your mercy, which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake me and I die. See now, this city is near enough to flee to, and it is a little one. Please let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live. Lot's time in Sodom had cultivated fear in his heart rather than faith. Lot has been invited to meet with God in the mountains, but he prefers the clamor of another city, now just a smaller city. And he said to him, see, I have favored you concerning this thing also, in that I will not overthrow this city for which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. God allows Lot to escape to a smaller city. This small city, therefore, the name of it was Zoar, which, by the way, means small. The point is, God's judgment won't come until his people are safe, and so Lot is allowed to escape to the city of Zoar. And that's the way it will be at the end of the age. When the great tribulation rocks this planet off its foundations, you see, before judgment comes down, the church will go up. God promises his people a means of escape. When the fires of judgment ravage the earth, the people of God will be safe and secure in heaven as long as we don't look back, as long as we don't hold on, as long as we don't linger, as long as we anticipate and are ready and look for the coming of our Lord Jesus in the clouds for his church. And then verse 23, the sun had risen upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar. In other words, he had left Sodom at dawn, but since he lingered, the sun is now high in the sky. And then the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. Sodom and its sister city, its neighboring city, Gomorrah, were located in the valley of Siddim on what is today the shores of the Dead Sea. Genesis 14, verse 10 tells us the valley of Siddim was full of asphalt pits. In other words, the region was known for its salt and sulfur deposits. And it's been suggested that God may have sent a lightning bolt, which hit a pocket of gas in one of these asphalt pits, and it exploded and rained down fire and brimstone on the cities. We don't really know how God did it, but we know he did. The whole valley was burned to a crisp. It was Billy Graham who once said, if God does not judge America, he'll have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. For today, we are guilty of more than Sodom. For we have normalized same-sex relations and exalted them to the level of marriage. This is an abomination in the eyes of God. And if God judged Sodom, then he'll have no hesitation judging us. So God overthrew these cities, all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. But Lot's wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. You could say Lot's wife got assaulted coming out of Sodom. She became a podium of sodium. Been waiting to say that. And note Mrs. Lot, she left Sodom, but Sodom never left her. That was the problem. Her body left, but not her heart. She loved the pleasures and the treasures of this world more than the new life that God had promised her. Apparently, she was bitter at God for having to leave Sodom, and God immortalized her bitterness by turning her into a tower of salt. And as I noted earlier, Jesus uses this story as a warning to us, believers living in the last days. Luke 17, verse 30 tells us, even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. For in that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house, let him not come down to take them away. And likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back. For remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. Don't let this world get its hooks in you. Don't do it. If so, you'll miss out on God's best. After you come to Christ, don't look back. And then verse 27. And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. Abraham is back at his tent, and he goes out to spend time with God. It's interesting, from Genesis 12 through chapter 22, there are over 100 conversations between God and Abraham. Here was a man who lived in constant conversation with God. Abraham loved communing with God, but on this morning, he walks out of his tent and he sees smoke in the distance. And then he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain, and he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land, which went up like the smoke of a furnace. And it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had dwelt. Then Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountains, and his two daughters were with him, for he was afraid to dwell in Zoar. He must have thought that God would judge Zoar just as he had judged Sodom. And he and his two daughters dwelt in a cave. In other words, fear dominates their hearts. They were called to the mountains to seek God, but now they dwell in a cave. And what follows is so tragic. For Lot's two daughters show how indoctrinated they were in the perversions of Sodom. One weekend, they get their dad sloppy drunk. The first night, the firstborn takes him to bed. The second night, the younger girl does. He sires two children in those two nights. Lot ends up with the peculiar distinction of becoming a dad and a granddad simultaneously. Incest riddles what is left of Lot's family. See, Lot may have managed to retain the title righteous man while living in Sodom, but certainly his family didn't. His wife loved Sodom's possessions, looking back with a longing gaze. His daughters learned Sodom's perversions and got their own father drunk so that he would sire their sons. See, it all proved that compromise with sin brings dire consequences. If not on you immediately, it will ultimately bring consequences on your family. And so verse 37 sort of wraps it up. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day. And the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the people of Ammon, the Ammonites, to this day. And through the centuries, these tribes, the Ammonites and the Moabites, ended up causing the Israelites a heap of trouble. They became idolaters and ultimately God's enemies. With chapter 20, after that encouraging chapter, let's move to chapter 20. And Abraham journeyed from there to the south and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and stayed in Gerar. This was Philistine country. And now Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, "Oh, she is my sister." Sound familiar? Hey, this is what he said 25 years earlier to the Pharaoh in Egypt in Genesis 12. And do you remember Abram's rationale for this lie? See, Sarah was so gorgeous that he worried the pagan king would kill him to take her as his wife. We were amazed that this was his concern when Sarah was 65. Now the old girl's 90 and apparently still pretty enough to be attractive to an Oriental king. If only Sarah had left us her secret. Or maybe she has. For 1 Peter chapter 3 encourages all Christian women to have the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. To be submissive to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham. See, spiritual beauty is timeless. It never wrinkles. A submissive spirit is always beautiful and attractive. It's amazing, though, that Abraham repeats the same mistake he made two decades earlier. In between these two mistakes, Abraham had grown in his faith and in his knowledge of God. But apparently, Abraham had never taken the time to restructure his thinking toward his wife and his fears. So when thrown into the same situation, guess what? He responds in the exact same way. And this can happen to all believers. See, we come to know God and we begin to grow spiritually, but then a situation pops up that presses us for a response. And since we've never retrained our minds to think according to the new life God has given us, we revert back to the way we used to cope with things. And we fall into the same traps because we never transformed our thinking according to God's wisdom. This is why Ephesians 4 verse 23 tells us, be renewed in the spirit of your mind. You got to retrain your thoughts. And so Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Indeed, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." But Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, "Lord, will you slay a righteous nation also? Did he not say to me, 'She is my sister'?" And she, even she herself, said, "He is my brother. In the integrity of my heart, in innocence of my hands, I've done this." And God said to him in a dream, "Yes, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart. For I also withheld you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her." God knew Abimelech had been lied to. And so he honored the king's integrity. and he kept him from adultery with Sarah. And now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. And that was Abraham who lied to Abimelech. And yet Abraham gets introduced as a prophet. And God promises Abimelech that Abraham will pray for him. I'm sure Abimelech's thinking, I should be praying for Abraham. Verse 8. And so Abimelech rose early in the morning, called all his servants, and told all these things in their hearing. And the men were very afraid. And Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, what have you done to us? How have I offended you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? And you have done deeds to me that ought not to be done. And then Abimelech said to Abraham, what did you have in view that you have done this thing? In other words, what were you thinking, man? And Abraham said, because I thought surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife. But indeed, she is truly my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. Sarah was Abraham's half-sister. So he's actually making a half-truth here, stating a half-truth. But as it said, a half-truth said with the intent to deceive still makes for a whole lie. And it came to pass when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, this is your kindness that you should do for me. In every place, wherever we go, say of me, he is my brother. Abraham admits that they had schemed this all ahead of time. That wherever they went, they told the same lies. And this lie, like most lies, was caused by fear. In their minds, they're thinking, since God can't protect me, I'll manipulate the truth. I'll protect myself. How wrong was that? Well, verse 14. Then Abimelech took sheep, oxen, and male and female servants and gave them to Abraham. And he restored Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, see, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you. Then to Sarah he said, behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Notice he's being a bit sarcastic there when he calls Abraham her brother. Little dig. Indeed, this vindicates you before all who are with you and before everybody. And thus she was rebuked. She too had lied and needed to be rebuked. And so Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, and his female servants. And then they bore children, for the Lord had closed up all the wounds of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. All is well when they leave. Well, chapter 21. And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. Friends, God always does just as he has spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. And the name means, he will laugh. You remember both Abraham and Sarah laughed at God's promise that a 90-year-old could bear a son? But as we know, God is the one who always gets the last laugh. Picture in your mind this funny sight. You'll laugh too. I love this picture. Two silver-haired seniors, 90 and 100, with their newborn baby. It really is a laughable miracle. Recall, 25 years now have elapsed between the giving of this promise and now the receiving of this promise. And you can always expect a delay between the giving and the receiving of God's promise. That's why most of the time we live in the in-between time between the giving and receiving of a promise. And that's why it takes both faith and patience to inherit God's promises. Well, then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Circumcision, you remember, was the sign of the Abrahamic covenant, which reminds me of a Boston rabbi. You heard of this Boston rabbi? He's a big baseball fan. And he once had something in, he said he had something in common with Joe DiMaggio. Both were called the Yankee Clipper. Get it? Rabbi Joe DiMaggio, the Yankee Clipper, circumcision. When you have to explain it, it's not funny. Recall, it was God's earlier command to wait 8 days to circumcise your son. Did you know that modern science has observed that males receive a surge of vitamin K on day 8 of their life? This enhances the blood's clotting factor. And God knew this all along. Surprise! He created us. And that's why he postponed circumcisions until the 8th day to protect against the baby hemorrhaging. It's beautiful. Now, Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. It's even funny to read it. And Sarah said, God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me. She also said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? For I have borne him a son in his old age. I mean, really, who would have thunk it? Verse 8. So the child grew and was weaned. And Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. A weaned child is now eating on his own. He's in essence a toddler. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Now the word implies more than just friendly kidding or boyhood banter, teasing. Galatians 4 verse 29 says that Ishmael was persecuting Isaac. He was torturing his brother. Therefore, Sarah said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son. For the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, namely with Isaac. Abraham's liaison with Hagar was Sarah's idea, but now she sees Ishmael's brutal treatment of her son Isaac, and she wants Hagar and Ishmael thrown out of the tent. Verse 11. And the matter was very displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son. He loved Ishmael. At the time, Ishmael was 17 years old. Abraham had been a faithful dad to Ishmael. I mean, he and the boy had built strong ties. Think about it. Ishmael's maybe a junior in high school now. Abraham's coached him in baseball his whole life. They go fishing every weekend. They go hunting together in the fall. This was hard on Abraham. And he's not sure he wants to give in to Sarah's demand. But God said to Abraham, do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. Yet I will also make a nation of the son of the bondwoman because he is your seed. God assures Abraham that he is going to take care of Ishmael, that Ishmael would become a great nation in his own right. But the house of Abraham is not big enough for both sons, and Ishmael is now the odd man out. Isaac is the promised son, for in Isaac your seed shall be called, God said. And what was true of Abraham's household is true of the Middle East today. God has multiplied the Arabs, but the sod, the seed, the salvation, the promise God made to Abraham belonged to Isaac, not Ishmael. It belongs to the Jews, not the Arabs. Verse 14. So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water, and putting it on her shoulder, he gave it and the boy to Hagar and sent her away. Then she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba, there in southern Israel. And the water in the skin was used up, and she placed the boy under one of the shrubs. Then she went and sat down across from him at a distance of about a bow shot, for she said to herself, let me not see the death of my boy. And so she sat opposite him and lifted up her voice and wept. Imagine, rejected, abandoned. This woman and her son had been left for dead. And God heard the voice of the lad. Then the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said to her, notice the angel of the Lord, who might that be? perhaps our Lord Jesus. And he said, "What ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him with your hand, for I will make him a great nation." And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. And again, God comes to the aid of Hagar and Ishmael. Kicked out of Abraham's house, God doesn't abandon them. He opens Hagar's eyes to a well. He loved Ishmael as he loves the Arabs today. Ironically, but according to the New Testament, when an Arab, a Gentile, embraces Jesus as his Savior, he becomes a full-fledged child of Abraham and thus part of God's covenant. It's interesting, Abraham left Ishmael for dead, but Jesus died in Ishmael's place. And in the place of the Arabs today, salvation is for all of us. And then verse 20, "So God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, that is in the Sinai, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt." Now, the rest of chapter 21 records Abraham's dealings with his old friend Abimelech. The Philistine king saw God's favor on Abraham and wanted to form an alliance. Abraham agrees, but first he needs to settle a grievance. Water was scarce in the Negev, in the southern part of Israel, in that desert. And Abraham had dug a well that some of Abimelech's men had seized. Abimelech claimed to be ignorant of the matter. And so these two sheiks enter a covenant, and Abraham reaffirms his ownership of this well. And that's where we pick it up, verse 31. "Therefore he called that place Beersheba, because the two of them swore an oath there." Beersheba means well of the oath. "And thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. So Abimelech rose with Phicol, the commander of his army, and they returned to the land of the Philistines. Then Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, and there called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines many days." Which brings us to a classic Bible chapter, Genesis chapter 22. After Isaac was born, Abraham rested and relaxed in Beersheba. But now his faith gets tested to the max. Which reminds me, did you hear of the cool video games that Abraham had running on his laptop? Well, Isaac was checking them out with a concerned look on his face. Isaac says to Abraham, he says, "Dad, I don't think your computer has enough memory to run all these games." And Abraham replied, "Son, don't worry, God will provide the RAM." Genesis chapter 22. "Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham." This is a test. "And said to him, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. And he said, Take now your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love." Notice God calls Isaac Abraham's only son. God doesn't even acknowledge Ishmael, for Isaac is the covenant recipient. And this also brings hope to all forgiven sinners like you and me. For if God doesn't mention Ishmael, then it's obvious that he has forgotten Abraham's lapse of faith and his sin with Hagar. Here's proof that what God forgives, he forgets. God remembered Ishmael, but not the work of the flesh that birthed him. What God forgives, he forgets. Aren't you glad? I am so glad. And notice verse 2, the word love. It's the first time the term appears in the Bible. And it speaks of a father's love for his son. Abraham loved Isaac. And God loves us. But God tells Abraham to take Isaac and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Now here is the ultimate test of faith. Imagine raising a knife with the intent of slitting the throat of your only son, offering him as a sacrifice. And what made this command so confusing was that Isaac was heir to God's promises. God's command here flies in the face of both love and logic. And yet Abraham obeys. So Abraham rose early in the morning and he saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son. And he split the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey, the lad, and I will go yonder and do what? And worship. And we will come back to you." Notice the phrase, "we will come back to you." Apparently, Abraham believed that God was going to raise Isaac from the dead. Hebrews 11 tells us that. It tells us that Abraham concluded that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. And notice the insight there in Hebrews. This was not only a test for Abraham, but a picture for us. For as Abraham hiked these 50 miles from Beersheba to Moriah to offer his only son, God the Father journeyed to this very same mountain 2,000 years later to offer his son, his only son, Jesus, for you. See, Moriah was one of the hills of the city of Jerusalem. And in Abraham's day, there was a settlement about halfway up the mountain. That means that Abraham probably climbed above that settlement to an isolated place where he offered Isaac, at the very top of the hill, at the place that would later be called Golgotha or Mount Calvary. See, Abraham offered his son Isaac on the exact spot that God would later offer his only son, Jesus. It's interesting to see the cross from the disciples' point of view. You need to read the Gospels. To visit the cross from the son's perspective, read Psalm 22. But in Genesis 22, we come to the cross from the father's viewpoint. And in Abraham, we see the father's heart on display. Verse 6. So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. Abraham takes the wood to burn the sacrifice, wood that he had split. He lays it on Isaac. Jesus also carried wood up the same hill. He carried a Roman cross, didn't he? Notice back in verse 3, two men traveled with Abraham to offer Isaac, and there were two thieves on crosses that traveled with Jesus on his gruesome journey. And when did you think Isaac died in the mind of Abraham? It was probably when he left to make this trip. He probably already conceded. He knew what he was going to do. He was going to kill his only son. It's interesting. What's intriguing here is that according to verse 4, it took 3 days to reach Moriah. Thus, from Abraham's perspective, his son Isaac rose from the dead on the third day. The same was true for God's son, Jesus. Remember, too, both Isaac and Jesus were born of miraculous births. Isaac is a fascinating type of Christ, while Abraham is a type of God the Father. And so verse 7, but Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, "My father," and he said, "Here I am, my son." And then he said, "Look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering." And so the two of them went together. And then they came to the place of which God had told him. There was an exact spot where God wanted this drama to unfold. And I believe it was the same place that would later support Calvary's cross. And Abraham built an altar there. Abraham was good at building altars. Remember, he built them everywhere he went. Abraham was a worshiper. And Abraham placed the wood in order, and he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. Now realize, at this point, Isaac is a fully grown man. The Jewish rabbis suggested that he was 30-something at this time. And for an old man like Abraham to bind Isaac to the altar, he needed a little cooperation from the boy, didn't he? You know, we talk about Abraham's faith, but what we should talk a little bit about is the faith of Isaac. Well, Abraham stretched out his hand, and he took the knife to slay his son. And try to imagine now what is happening in the heart of Abraham at this moment. I mean, his 100-year-old heart is pounding out of his chest. His mind is screaming, no. His frail hand is trembling. Tears are flowing down his cheeks. His emotions are caught between a desire to obey and a love for his son. I mean, what gives Abraham the strength to stretch out his hand and lift up his knife and do the impossible? It was faith. Faith that God would raise Isaac from the dead. Faith that somehow God would work this whole thing out. And it's faith that strengthens us in the midst of life's tests. Well, just as Abraham is about to plunge the knife into his son, the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. By faith, Abraham passes God's test. And then Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. And so Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place, the Lord will provide, in Hebrew, Jehovah Jireh, or God my provider. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord, it shall be provided. See, Isaac was not the sinless sacrifice that God ultimately requires. Thus, God stopped the hand of Abraham, but 2,000 years later, he won't stop his own hand, for Jesus is the ram, the Lamb of God, that takes away the sin of the whole world. And then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. And it's Paul in Galatians chapter 3, verse 16, that makes a big deal out of the fact that the word here, seed, is in its singular form, not plural. In other words, in your seed, not seeds, all the nations shall be blessed. Paul says this is a reference to one seed, one man, Jesus Christ. Salvation comes through a special offspring of Abraham, Christ Jesus. Note today's chapters begin with judgment, yet they end with mercy. The same God who judged Sodom's sin willingly sent his son to die in the place of all similar sinners. And then verse 19. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they rose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. And the chapter ends with a short genealogy of Abraham's brother Nahor, which introduces us to a young girl named Rebekah who becomes a wife for Isaac. And that's what's next in Genesis chapter 23.